Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
I feel like a locomotive, sipping, drinking Arizona. Mixtape just around the corner, did a lot in California. Can't wait to drop this, don't you? Yeah, they gon' have fun with that. Smash like Songa, man, my songs gon' break through like a running back.
Welcome back to the podcast that is always up to speed with Formula One. Today is Sunday, March 31st, 2024. The first third, or quarter? Third? No, I guess it's the first quarter of this year is out of the way. Time is just flying by. Mark Daly here on a beautiful Sunday morning in Vancouver, Canada. And I'm joined by Mr. Sam Cooper from Planet F1. Sam, how are you doing today?
I'm very good, thanks. It's less sunny in London, unfortunately. It's quite cold today, but I think living in London, you get used to that. So I'm jealous of your weather.
Yeah, well, that's about the first time anybody ever said that about the weather in Vancouver in the springtime. but there you go. We'll take the compliments when we can get it. Well, thank you so much for dropping by. I got a lot to talk about. But before we do that, I just want to give a few shout outs here. First of all, to Magnus and the crew over at the Race Weekend magazine. You can head on over and check them out at theraceweekend.com. And that is RACEWKND.com. Use my promo code ScuderiaPod at checkout to receive a 10% discount on a year subscription. And also check out what Thies and the crew have assembled at RacingExclusives.com for unique Formula One merchandise that comes with their certificate of authenticity. Check out what they have in the shop at RacingExclusives.com. All right, Sam, well, I've been looking forward to doing this for the past couple of days since we finally managed to prick a date and time in the calendar. Now, before we jump into it, and of course, you know, we have had this very, very I don't even want to say eventful because like the last 3 months, you know, like eventful is like it's a total understatement, right? But I've received a little bit of intel that in addition to all the great work you're doing over at Planet F1, that rumor has it you've started your own McLaren like based podcast. Is this accurate?
That is very true. Yeah, that's one of the rumors I can actually confirm. Yeah, so it's called Pondering Papaya and it's basically, I'm sure you've got it over in North America kind of thing. Like, I feel like in other sports, there's loads of podcasts about individual teams, but whereas F1 didn't really have that. Like, I was looking around, there wasn't overly, unless it was produced by the teams themselves. So I thought, I want to start somewhere, I want to start my own podcast kind of thing, get some interesting people on, like, and which team is better to do it really than McLaren? Obviously, they've got a huge history, they got on the rise, you'd probably say, like the last year or so since those upgrades have come. So yeah, it's been hugely fun. So yeah, I'd really encourage anyone. You don't have to be a McLaren fan. Like, we sort of touch on McLaren, but we'll also talk about the other stuff. But yeah, Pondering Papaya on all the major podcast networks, which I'm sure if you're listening to this, you will be able to find it. So yeah, I'd implore people just to subscribe.
So I'm going to test now your legitimacy here. So there's only one correct answer to this question. Is the most beautiful car McLaren ever designed and built the MP44 or the MP44? Now, take your time. I want you to think about this.
It's a tricky one. I'm going to go with the MP44.
Well, that's good for you because that was indeed the correct answer. You know.
Yeah, I was lucky enough to see, I've been to McLaren a few times, and every time you see that row of cars, like, that's always one that stands out. Like, it's such a work of art. And obviously, because what it did during that season, like, it was an amazing season with two of the best drivers ever, really, to be in it. So yeah, a great car and a great season.
Yeah, I mean, you nailed it. I mean, they have built and designed so many beautiful cars over the year, but they knocked it out of the park, I think, you know, in successive years or designs. They had the MP44, the MP45, and the MP46, you know, all late 80s, early 90s, just absolutely gorgeous, you know, clean lines, just beautiful, you know, beautiful to look at. And that combination of that white and that day glow orange, that they had that they used in the 80s on the car. It just works. And I was thinking about it the other night, and I think the first time I ever saw an MP4-6 was probably about 1995, the museum at Brooklands in Weybridge. And it was just, you know, you're just sort of magnetically like attracted to it, because I mean, you know, the museum they have there, you know, it's been 30 years since I've been there, but you know, when I walked in, it was just like, you know, tractor beam. It's just sort of locked in, and you know, take as many pictures as I could. And you know, that was a film camera at the time, so 24 exposures were very rapidly filled up, and I was putting a new film in. But very cool. Well, we could talk about that a little bit later on. I mean, it's great to hear. I've been doing a lot of great work at Planet F1, and excited to hear how your the new pod plans out. But you know, as we were saying, you know, Sam, just now, I mean, the past 3 months in Formula One has been eventful, to say the least. I mean, we've had the whole, you know, it's funny, with all the drama that was happened, and I was talking about it with Mark Hamilton the other day when we were having coffee, it's just like somewhere along the line, we all forgot about Andretti and all the drama, because, you know, as soon as the Andretti snub was announced, Lewis announced he was going to Ferrari, and that was quickly forgotten about, this whole affair Christian Horner, which has just dragged on. And somewhere in between then, we had several days of winter testing in Bahrain, and then we, you know, as the Christian Horner thing has dragged on and on and on, we've had three races, and we've had a lot of different things. We've seen Carlos Sainz come down with appendicitis. We've seen young Ollie Bearman jump into the Ferrari, and he scored points on his debut in Formula One. I mean, there's so many like crazy things. I don't remember a season starting as dramatic as this one, and I've been watching, you know, Formula One literally forever because I'm old. But I wanted to get your take on the past couple of months. I know that's a loaded question. We could talk about 45 minutes, just what happened in that time, but go for it. Try and recap.
Yeah, you're completely right. Like, I think you could take any of these events and they could be worthy of being huge news stories on their own, because obviously you mentioned Andretti, and I think it was like a week later we had both Lando and Charles sign new contracts. Yes. And that's probably that's the kind of world we're in, where like these fairly big stories, fairly big rumors, whatever, they sort of are over in like a day, because there's new news and there's the Hamilton stuff to fry, like you said, the Christian Horner stuff. And like, yeah, it feels like we've had like half a season's worth of stories, and we've had three races. Like, we haven't even got to Europe yet. Like, we're still some way off the European season starting. So yeah, it's been a mad time, really. Like, I think me as Joe, it's like I've actually really enjoyed it, because usually about this time of the season where it's sort of everyone's just sort of waiting a little bit, maybe the upgrades aren't there yet kind of thing. But this has been like every day something new kind of thing. And fair enough, the on-track action hasn't been great, if I can say that. Like, obviously, we've had some really interesting stories. Like you mentioned, with Ollie Bearman doing really well, and then Sainz obviously coming back to win the race. But I think Formula One's been absolutely mad this year. And I think it's going to have to simmer down a little bit. But hopefully, now that the off-track stuff looks like it's sort of coming to an end kind of thing, but maybe the on-track stuff, as the teams start getting more used to their cars, as they get more upgrades, maybe we'll start having some more competitive racing, I say with fingers crossed.
You know, and you brought up Charles and Lando signing new contracts, and then also in the mix we have the rumors that Adrian Newey is being tempted to go to Aston Martin. Susie Wolf is suing the FIA. Oh, and of course the big one is the ongoing rumor that Max is going to leave Red Bull and go to Mercedes to take Lewis's seat. So nothing to see here, folks. You know, it's business as usual. It's
If there's a quiz at the end of this season, it's going to be the hardest quiz ever, because you're not going to remember a single thing that happened a week ago, let alone a few months ago.
Well, that's just it. Well, let's try and back it up, at least go back to the first race of the season that we saw in Bahrain. And I think that, you know, going back at least from, you know, my point of view, that I kind of had this sinking feeling, right, that it's going to be business as usual, because, you know, we have Max and Red Bull disappearing down the track, and it looks like, you know, nobody's going to be able to keep touch with them, and they're just it's going to be business as usual, and sort of kind of like, you know, the same again at Jeddah when we get to Saudi, and then we get this ray of hope that at the Australian Grand Prix last weekend with Carlos, and we see that weird scenario that a Red Bull has a DNF, like a mechanical, you know, failure, which is, you know, unheard of. I'm very much like in the past decade with the Mercedes, who were also literally bulletproof. You could almost count the mechanical failures that that Lewis and Rosberg and Bottas had on their cars during that time. So, you know, but backing it up to Bahrain, there it was discouraging, but you know, there was that ray of hope because, you know, Max was on pole. Checo was, you know, he only qualified on row, I think it was row 3, maybe even row 4. So maybe there was some, but, you know, it kind of goes from there. But your thoughts?
Yeah, I think you're right. I think it was maybe not depressing is the right word, but worrying that we were going to get more of the same as we did last year. But I think actually, like, I think the pack is a bit closer. Like, it's something I've sort of been asking myself and asking other people, like, I think Ferrari is the best team to look at, really. Is Ferrari closer to Red Bull than they are to, say, McLaren and Mercedes and Aston Martin? I think you'd have to say yes. I think at the moment it looks like there's a clear 1 and 2. Like, you'd still put Red Bull ahead because, obviously, of what they've done last year and how they've started this year. But I think Ferrari are a lot closer. And I think, in a way, it was a bit of a shame to see Max DNF so early in Australia because it did look like Sainz had a chance to battle with him, and that could have been something that we saw throughout the race, and he may have won. Of course, he won on merit, but he may have won with a full Max up against him. So, yeah, I agree with you. Bahrain's a little bit depressing, and you sort of, I think there were a few teams that came away probably thinking, oh, we could have done better there. And obviously, I think McLaren would be in that subject. I think Mercedes are definitely in there. Aston Martin still have got work to do. But I think for Ferrari and Red Bull, they're probably both where you sort of think they are. And I think that's the battle that we're going to see over the next few races, few months kind of thing. I'm not entirely sure it's going to be like the 2021 battle between Mercedes and Red Bull, but I think Ferrari do have the ability at least to sort of take a few more wins off Red Bull. I'm still going to give Red Bull both titles. I think that's looking very likely, but I think it's not going to be as easy as last year. And I think both Sainz and Leclerc probably will start challenging Max, and to a lesser extent Checo, because we know he's not a great qualifier, and obviously he has to make up for that other race. But yeah, I think Bahrain less encouraging, but Australia more encouraging, leading into Suzuka next week. So that should be another, hopefully, interesting race.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. If you kind of look at the first two races of the year, if you look at Bahrain, if you look at Saudi Arabia, you have Max, who was about 20-something seconds ahead of Carlos Sainz, who finishes P2. And he's a couple of seconds ahead, I guess, or maybe I should just go back and just double-check my memory here. But looking at the race classification, oh, yes, pardon me. So it was Max winning Bahrain. Checo was P2. So there's 20 seconds between the two of them. Then there's only a couple of seconds between Checo and Carlos Sainz, and then about 14 seconds or so to his teammate Charles Leclerc. And then kind of going down the rest of the, you know, the, like, down to about P8 or P9, there's only a couple of seconds between them. You have your nice mix of McLarens, Ferraris, Mercedes, and then you kind of have the Aston Martins a little bit spaced out, a little bit further back, like you accurately said. They still have a little bit of work to do. And then a similar situation again when we get to Saudi Arabia, that it's Max. This time the gap is a little bit closer to Sergio, who finishes P2, and then you've got Charles in P3. He's only about 4 or 5 seconds, and then you get this gap again, and you get this nice mix of Aston Martins and Mercedes and McLarens and Ferraris and everything. And I think that's why excuse me, why Australia last weekend was so encouraging, because you've heard all the stuff like this subsequently, except for Helmut Marko, who seems to live in his own like world, who says, you know, it's something contrary to everyone else. And, you know, like even Sergio Perez said after the race that they just didn't have the pace this weekend. And you hear what the, you know, Ferrari is saying, et cetera. And it's just like, you know, that Carlos was going to be, or the Ferraris were going to be faster than the Red Bulls. And then I can't remember what Marco's comment was. You might remember. It was something that if Max didn't retire, it was something that his pace would have been terrifying or something like that. But
yeah, you know. I mean, that sounds like Marco, doesn't it? Like you said, living his own little world.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, right.
Sure. Sure thing, Marco.
Yeah. Well, you know, the thing is, like, I was, you got Marco on one side, you got like Perez, who's in the other, like the on the other side. He's the guy in the car. He's the one driving it, and he's the one saying, "Yeah, you know, we just didn't have it today." day. But, you know, yet, you know, the figurehead of the team is the one saying, oh, yeah, no, our pace is terrifying today. It's like, yeah, sure. No, I'm
maybe Helmut Marko has his own little screen of just made up numbers. But no one's told him. He's just, we're doing amazing.
It's a screensaver on his laptop or something. It's like some data from last year. But, you know, let's before we talk about like that a little bit more, we talked really, really quickly about Ollie Bierman. Like, how special was that? And I know that Hülkenberg kind of like tempered it a little bit, saying that, you know, Bierman still has to deliver an F2, that if he can't continue to do good things there, then, you know, ultimately that performance in Formula One, it just becomes like a bit of a flash in the pan, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. Like, I mean, Nick de Vries is a perfect example, isn't it? He came in, did really well at Williams, scored points. But when it came to actually having a full-time seat, he just wasn't up to it. So, yeah, Bearman did incredible. Like, not only did he come in with such minimal notice, but he also came in at Ferrari. I don't think you can overestimate what that's like driving for Ferrari, all that pressure, everything on top of your shoulders, and yet you do that well. And let's not forget, towards the end of the race, I can't remember the exact order, but he had, like, Hamilton, Norris, all behind it. So these are people he would have grown up watching, especially Hamilton, obviously, and yet he's able to fend them off. But, yeah, I think Hülkenberg's right that we're seeing more and more that these young guys are coming in and doing so amazingly well. Like, obviously, I mentioned De Vries, but Liam Lawson last year, he had such a good run when Ricciardo injured his hand. Like, we're seeing these F2, whatever drivers coming in, and they're pretty much ready to go. But it's about taking that next step. It's about, can they continue being that good? And I think Hülkenberg's right to point that out. Maybe, obviously, he's probably got one eye on his own seat, because there's been a few talks that Bearman might go to Haas, and Hülkenberg's like, well, prove yourself first. This is my seat kind of thing. But, yeah, I think a good F2 season, I mean, whatever that means, does it mean he has to win the title? Does it mean he just has to finish the top three, whatever? I think it's looking likely that he'll get an F1 seat. Whether that's next year, I mean, it could be. I think, like I said, Haas is probably the most logical step. One of those two probably will drop out. It's looking more like Magnussen at this stage. But, yeah, or whether he waits another year and does sort of like a Liam Lawson kind of thing, and sort of sit in the sidelines and wait. But, yeah. He looks like a driver that's definitely going to be an F1 at some point. It was an incredibly assured drive, like a very hard track to be dropped in on, and sort of the heat of the day and like kind of thing. But yeah, great drive for him, and sort of I think everyone's sort of now waiting to see what his future is going to be, because it does look like it's going to be an F1.
You know, if regardless if you're Ollie Bearman or someone else, you have to think that the one shining role model they all look to would have to be Max, right? I mean, if you dial back 10 years ago, and that's why I think these discussions with Mercedes, you know, alleged discussions, or the rumor at least, is interesting, because before he got that drive with Toro Rosso, like, Toto offered him that reserve driver role at Mercedes a decade ago, but that was sort of, well, almost a decade ago. But I mean, that's that sort of like peak Hamilton Rosberg era, and, you know, Lewis was winning championships, and it was pretty clear that Rosberg, you know, he, you know, given the chance, you know, he might have what it takes to win a championship as well, which he ultimately did in 2016. So I don't think you can blame Toto at that time for offering Max, especially at like 16 or 17, whatever he was at the time, a reserve driver role, you know. And then so Max and his team, they decide to, well, you know, thanks but no thanks. We've got the opportunity to go to Toro Rosso. I mean, why would she? Like, I mean, I know hindsight is 20/20 for both parties here. But it was the right choice for Max. And, you know, and that's why it's kind of interesting when you, like, when you're talking about De Vries, and we can talk about Ricciardo later, because they're just the latest example of the old, you know, the old revolving door. It doesn't matter if it's Toro Rosso or, you know, AlphaTauri or whatever we're calling them this week, or Red Bull proper, you know, they have this history of it. But it's amazing because, you know, Max spends a bit of time at Toro Rosso, and obviously it looks like he's a legit driver. It's just like, you know, what could he do in a better team? He gets that, you know, that opportunity because Danny Kvyat, who was the number two driver at Red Bull on that day, had this rather unfortunate pastime of driving into other cars, you know, on a regular basis. and I believe it, because like I believe he ran up the back of Seb Vettel's gearbox in Sochi that year. I don't remember the particulars, but you know, it was Kvyat that was switched around for Max, and then and Max wins that first race for Red Bull, and it's kind of almost started. I mean, it was a bit of a slow burn because they had a couple of years there before they had the power unit to match the car, because that Renault power it's anemic. You know, it struggles, but it's interesting because if you kind of look at, you know, Max's story, you know, to kind of bring this long-winded whatever this was to a close, that if you're Oliver Behrman or whoever, you have to think that, well, if Max could do it, then, you know, like, why can't I? You know, that you know, age doesn't seem to be as a big of a thing anymore. And if Ferrari realize it, and when they brought both Carlos Sainz and Charles Leclerc into the team at the same time, that, you know, they historically went for the older, you know, proven drivers and former champions, etc., that there was this shift in logic in Formula One.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Yeah, definitely. Like, I think back in the early days, I can't remember what age Hamilton was, but he definitely was. He was like early 20s, not teenage years kind of thing. That was sort of the way to do it, wasn't it? He had a few years in F3 or whatever it was, then F2, and then finally F1, sort of when they were the finished products. And like you said, now it's the complete opposite. I don't really know what the cause of that. Maybe it's because simulators have got a lot better, so they have a lot of time in behind that. Obviously, testing for a rookie is really limited in these current regulations. Like, it's only now that they can start testing like cars from 2022, which is obviously the same regulations as the car we're using now. So it's not as though they get a load of on-track time. It's sort of they occasionally get an FP1 session or whatever kind of thing, and they've just got to be ready for it. And I think it's a testament to how well they do as drivers that they can just drop in and do it. And like you said, Max is the perfect example. Like, it's interesting you pick that up, because I was actually in Austria last week, and they've got the F1 exhibition there. Oh. So they had a big bit of all the drivers and sort of like how they got to F1. Like, it was it basically started at the lowest level, and it has worked its way up. And then you see like Hamilton is like a slow, steady progression, but then you get to Max, it's like a straight line upwards and then to F1. And that just demonstrated like how bizarre his career has been, like how quickly he's gone up, and like he's coming up to X amount of races and he's still only 26. So yeah, he's a perfect example of what you can do. And that old adage, you're not old enough, you're good enough kind of thing. Like, if you can prove you can drive, Red Bull in particular, I really must say that it's Red Bull on this as well. They don't care what age you are, they'll happily throw you in the car. Like, get into Red Bull when you're battling Hamilton and Rosberg, like you'll be fine, off you go kind of thing. So yeah, he's a perfect example. But also, like, we've got to remember, like, a huge amount of luck's involved in this. Like, if we think back to that Barcelona race, like, say Hamilton and Rosberg didn't crash into each other.
Yes.
Does Max finish on the podium? Does he finish P4? And then it's a less of a start to his career. Like, obviously, he's a really talented driver, and everyone sort of realizes that, and he would have probably made it to the top anyway. But it's these little moments, that these little bits of, not luck, but, like, good fortune that can really help a driver, like, get to the top and stay at the top. And arguably, Ollie Behrman has had his moment now, where one of the Ferrari drivers randomly got appendicitis, and that's his way in. So yeah, I'm sure he's a driver that's got a lot of potential. I wouldn't be surprised if one day he is in the Ferrari full time.
You know, the full disclosure that this podcast is now the official Carlos Sainz fan club. You know, I
I'm all for it. I love Carlos.
I love a good underdog story. And I see a lot of reasons why Lewis would want to go to Ferrari. And I don't really begrudge him for making that move. And, you know, even though that resulted in Sainz losing his seat for next year. But I love that at least through the first couple of of races of the year. Carlos is succeeding despite everything else going on around him. And it's interesting too, if you kind of just listen to some of the little nuggets or read some of the little pieces, little snippets here and there of what Carlos has to say, and he doesn't seem overly stressed at the moment. And obviously he has to secure something, but ultimately he must be having discussions with different teams in different places. And I think it was interesting too, because actually I think it might have been an article that I read on Planet F1 that Eddie Jordan's theory is that if it doesn't work out for Carlos somewhere else, that he might in fact end up teaming up with his childhood hero, the ageless Fernando Alonso at Aston Martin in 2025. Now, keep this in mind that, Eddie, I think, is a bit of an eccentric person. He's a bit of a showman, which I've always said that Eddie will say almost anything. But I thought it was, that being said, I thought it was an interesting, a quote that he had, because it wasn't so much that it felt like he was kind of like showing his hand a little bit. No, he had a little bit of inside knowledge, basically saying if it doesn't happen or if it does happen, don't be surprised. That's basically, in flamboyant Eddie Jordan manner, that's basically what he was saying, right?
Yeah, if we were hinting that Helmut Marko loves a microphone, I think Eddie Jordan takes it another level. He'll happily say absolutely everything. But I think he has got a point this year, on that point at least. I think if you look at every team on the grid, Sainz could arguably walk into most of them. So other than Ferrari, where he's left, obviously, and McLaren as well, because obviously they've got two drivers that are locked in for a long time. Other than that, you could easily make a case for him joining pretty much any other team. I think he'd be an asset to one of the top teams, whether that's even someone like Red Bull, if they decide to go for Perez, obviously get rid of Perez, and get Sainz in, who was part of the makeup many years ago before he went off to Renault. That could be an option. Mercedes, I think they'd do really well to get someone like Sainz in. I think they're all sort of hoping that maybe Antonelli is going to be ready in time, but he's still very, we were talking about being very young. He's still very young, even more younger than Behrman. He's still very raw, and I think he might not be ready for next year kind of thing. So Sainz would be a perfect choice there. Aston Martin, like you mentioned, that'd be a great move for him, and for the team, you'd imagine. But then again, you've got that one thing, that one question about Racing Point or Aston Martin, where it's cool, what happens to Lance Stroll? If Lance Stroll wants to carry on racing, he's probably going to be able to carry on racing. His dad owns the team. So as much as we'd like to see that Alonso-Sainz partnership, it might be a bit hard to do, considering who's in the second seat. But I think it'd be a real shame to see Sainz go to a team that's not fighting for podiums or wins. I think he's in the best form of his career. He's doing unbelievably well since Singapore last year, when he got his second win. Yeah, it'd be his second win. And it was such an assured and confident drive. He was essentially using the other team against themselves. He was I'm just going to let Lando catch up a little bit so then he can put off whoever's behind him. That's just such a smart move to be doing at 200 miles an hour. And I think, again, Australia, it was another completely assured drive. He was so comfortably in the lead. It was Max-esque, wasn't it? The way he was just holding off everyone at bay, keeping his tyres alive. So I think he's a driver that's really at the top of his game right now. And I think it'd be hard to say any other drivers in better form, obviously, aside from Max. That's always going to be the caveat in this era. Aside from Max, Sainz is probably the best driver on the grid at the moment. So I think he could walk into any team. It probably just depends, not only the salary they offer, but also probably how many years they offer. I think that could be crucial for him. So someone like Mercedes may only offer a 1 or 2 year deal, and Sainz might want longer than that. I think that's probably why he's not so worried. I think he's very much, if he's put himself in the shop window, he's now the absolute gleaming thing in the shop window. He's the only thing you see in the shop window. So I think, he's going to have a seat next year. My only hope is that it's at a team that he can still be competitive at, because I think his driving deserves it.
Yeah, absolutely. It's interesting too, if you look at the other teams around the grid, it's obvious that Ferrari have made that step. And last year was always going to be an interesting year, because Fred Vasseur comes in at the beginning of January or whatever it is. And it's how much is he really going to be able to do? Because the car at that point is basically set and done. There's not too much they can do. It's still basically Mattia Bonotto's team. It's still basically Mattia Bonotto's car. And I was talking about it on the pod when when I did it on Thursday night. And you kind of go back, and if you read Ross Braun's book, Total Competition, he always looked at these things as like a three-year project. You come in year one, you kind of assess and see exactly, get a feel for what the landscape is. Year two, you start making changes and setting up the team that you want to run it the way that you want. And year three, then you're off and running in theory. I mean, it sounds very, very simple. And I mean, only a handful of people like Ross Braun probably is the only person that could do that. But, you know, that's how they do it. But I mean, I think that we can see at least now that we're starting to see concrete evidence of Fred Vasseur's influence on the team. I mean, granted, we're only three races into a very long season, so there's still plenty of times for, Ferrari to do to manifest as themselves, to do all the things. But, it's interesting to see. And I interviewed a fellow from the Wall Street Journal a couple of weeks ago. He wrote this book called The Formula. And it was interesting because, his name is John Clegg, and himself and his co-author, Josh Robinson, they went around, they talked to all these, interviewed all these people. Like, they went to Bernie Ecclestone's house, for example, and interviewed Bernie, and they interviewed Di Montezemolo, they interviewed Lewis, Max, like all these, like, and they basically cover Formula One, essentially from the beginning, but it really sort of picks up in the 60s, 70s, 80s, up until the modern times. But it's interesting because they have one chapter on Ferrari. And I highlighted it when I read the book, and I asked John about it, and I said, I think this is a very astute observation, because, basically the way they summed it up was that the history and myth around Ferrari is built around the history of a team that for most of their existence in Formula One, except for a couple of periods here and there, isn't really anything to get overly excited about, but yet they've got this huge mystique about them. I thought that was a brilliant summation for the one team that's been there right from day one.
Yeah, that is 100% right. Like, they're such an odd team, unique team, that it's Ferrari. Like, I think no other country is like so supportive of their own team. Obviously, like, Ferrari can sometimes be more important than the international football / soccer team in Italy. Like, it's seen as the country's team. And like, you're right, like, you look over their periods of history, like, they had a little bit of success at the start. Like, it's very much the highest of highs and the lowest of lows. And I think other manufacturers may have dropped out, kind of thing, but Ferrari have always stuck in there, just carried on. And I think you're right. This is sort of like the average Ferrari season, isn't it? Win a few races, do all right. But it's because we've had like drivers like Schumacher who've made it seem like, especially for like our generation, who grew up watching like Schumacher do that and like win every race time after time after time. This Ferrari mystique has sort of been built up over the decades. And yeah, the expectations are way higher for Ferrari, like, than any other team. Like, regardless of what their situation is, they're expected to win the world title. And I don't think you could realistically say that about others. Like, obviously the likes of Mercedes and Red Bull all want to win it, but I think there's an ability to think more like broader picture and say, okay, we're not the best. Like, I mean, you look at Red Bull during Mercedes dominant years, like, they accepted they weren't the best. They were going to try and get as many wins as possible. Whereas Ferrari, you have to win all the time. And like, it is a very much a pressure cooking environment. Like, it's so easy to get swept up in that. And I think that's something that Fred's done really well. Like, he's come in there at a time where Binotto had just left or been kicked out, depending on how you saw it. The strategy team was all over the place. Like, there was talk of Charles leaving. Like, there was so many errors, so many problems that looked like the team was going to explode. And yet he's come in and just gone like, all right, everyone, just calm down a little bit. It's going to be okay. You're all going to be fine. Like, let's just sort one problem after another and we'll sort of go from there. And like you said, you mentioned it earlier, like, we're now starting to see the fruits of that. Like, when was the last time we had a bad Ferrari strategy call? Like, it's been a long time since we had those ridiculous errors they used to make all the time. And I think both the drivers look more happy than they did this time last year. I think the team in general looks a bit more like upbeat and positive. And I think that, probably more than anything to do with the car, has been like Fred's biggest achievement so far, is that he's essentially just said, all right, forget everything that's happened so far, let's have a better positive morale, and that will help the races. And I think that's something that's happened to all the big teams. Like, if you look at McLaren, obviously when Zak Brown came in, he had a similar effect where he was like, okay, that was one way to do it under Ron Dennis, that was all good, but now we're going to do it like more of a happy, calmer environment. And that seems to be the way to get results in the modern environment. And I think, yeah, that's Fred's best job. Like, and obviously, I don't think Hamilton comes to Ferrari without Fred also being there. Like, that's a huge deal, and that's sort of something that Ferrari have wanted for years, and they've finally managed to do it. So, yeah, I think more than the car, I think, because obviously he is a technical man, he knows what he's talking about, but he'll obviously predominantly leave that to his technical chiefs to do all that. And I think his main achievement, or his main job, as it were, is to basically organize the people, be the head of the team, and make sure everyone realizes it's going to be okay, even if you don't win the race. Like, you don't have to set the country on fire. You don't have to come to Maranello with pitchforks and like big signs saying Ferrari. But yeah, like, it's going to be okay. So I think, yeah, like you mentioned, we're starting to see the effects of that. And I think that's why they're probably doing better than they were this time last year, or whenever you want to point to, really.
Yeah, I think Fred was saying even just this last week that the team has evolved to a point so far this year that the drivers aren't driving what he called survival mode. And then, you know, it's also interesting, too, because you talk about like all these calls that they make from the pit wall, or these strategy calls or whatever it might be, that it'd be interesting. You'd be watching the race in real time, and you'd be kind of thinking, watching, OK, well, some, you know, so-and-so switched to the different compound tires. They obviously went, and they always seem to do the contrary, or they do their own thing, and it would be really, really weird. It'd be funny because you'd be sitting there, you'd be thinking, okay, well, what's going? I know they're seeing stuff there because they have their telemetry, but just on the face of it, this doesn't make any sense. And I'd be getting messages from other people saying the same thing in real time. You go onto social media, there's like, what are they thinking? It's just like, you know, what are the rest of us seeing that they're not seeing? Granted, they have all the data and telemetry. It's just like, on the basic logical choice, like, why is it what's going wrong? You know, it's just like, so it's interesting there. But it's funny too, because I think that there's a great parallel to be drawn between Ferrari and McLaren, as you put it. Because, you know, if you dial it back about 10 years when they announced that they were going to get the Honda power, because you had Ferrari, Mercedes and Renault who'd committed to this new engine formula well in advance. They'd spent a lot of time developing these V6 turbo hybrid power units. So when they came online in 2014, they were ready to go. And then Honda comes in a year later and basically trying to develop the same competitive power units in about half the amount of time that the other manufacturers did, and it was just going to be, you know, it was going to be an impossible task. And I think that whole whole era of McLaren before, you know, Zach Brown came in, and then he started doing all the things that he'd done that sort of manifested in this new iteration of McLaren, was nicely sort of summed up. At least the woes were of that sort of mid-teens kind of crisis they had. When you remember when they were doing the formation lap one year at Sochi, where they're coming around just back onto the, you know, the start finish there, just to line up in their grid boxes, and Fernando's car dies, and he gets on the radio and he says something to his engineer, and he's like, he said, "Well, try this." He's like, "I've tried everything. Why don't you come out here and try it?" And I'm just like, that kind of summed up like the entire era. You know, it was frustrating to watch, but, you know, just sort of like taking all of that and kind of like distilling it down to its basics. If you get the right person at the top and they appoint the right people in different parts of the organizations, and granted, I mean, the race wins haven't come. I mean, Ricardo's only won, in Italy. They've had podiums here and there, but I mean, it's there's work to do. But they're in a far healthier place now, and they got two really, really good drivers. I think they've got one of the strongest driver pairings on the grid, to be quite honest, despite that Oscar Piastri's only a year and a bit into his Formula One career. I think it's an exciting team to watch.
Yeah, I think you're right. Like, they're probably the team that's transformed the most over the last 10 years. Like, you're right, that time of when Alonso and Button and Stoffel van Dorn as well, like, that was just probably the most depressing time ever of McLaren, wasn't it? Like you mentioned, the Honda engine just wasn't up to it. In a way, it's a shame, because obviously I think McLaren walked so that Red Bull could run, because obviously Honda got all their mistakes out of the way, and it just so happened they split off and they went to Red Bull and started providing amazing engines. Like, and McLaren probably like, oh, why did we do that? But I think,
I think that relationship happened. Not only that, they paid to break that contract. It was like £100 million pounds or $100 million or something. Like, they paid to get rid of those engines, and then they went and shopped them off to Red Bull. You know, it was the most bizarre thing, right?
It's one of those things that look back like, oh, God, why did we do that? But I think probably the relationship had already deteriorated beyond the point of being salvaged. Obviously, Alonso's calling it a GP3 engine most weekends. And, like, yeah, that was just the worst time to be McLaren. Like, the drivers weren't happy. I mean, it forced Alonso into retirement when he perhaps didn't want to retire, but he's just like, I've had enough. Yep. This is what my F1 career is going to be. It's over, kind of thing. So yeah, I think Zak Brown's done an incredible job. And like, it's interesting because I've been putting together an episode of sort of like, who is Zak Brown? You sort of see where he's coming from and sort of his passion for racing, not just F1, is really like rubbed off on McLaren. Like, they race in so many series, like, and that's bound to help the team, help morale. Like, I think everyone likes being part of the McLaren family, I guess. Mm-hmm. And we've seen that over the last year or so. They've managed to get some big names through the door, not just Piastri, obviously, but like Rob Marshall from Red Bull and like mm-hmm. David Sanchez from Ferrari. Like, they've got some big chief engineers or whatever their titles are in through the door. And that's only going to help them as the year goes on, because the way the gardening leave obviously works, they've only joined in January. So any work they'll do is going to carry on through the year. But it's not just the people side of it as well. Like, they finally got their wind tunnel back in the MTC, which is going to be a huge thing for them. Because you think in the past, they had to ship all their items over to Cologne and then wait to come back and then get all the data and then build something. But now it's going to be a much more streamlined process. And you're right, like, the wins haven't come yet. But I think, I mean, before the season, I was sort of backing McLaren to be up there with Red Bull and challenging. Like, I think that's something that's going to happen. Like, they're going to upgrade as the car goes on. Like, yeah, like, I think you're just as likely to see them winning races this year, next year, kind of thing, as you are any of the top teams, really. So yeah, I think, yeah, that's another team that's gone under a huge transformation, change, whatever you want to call it. But yeah, the McLaren of today is almost unrecognizable from the McLaren that we saw 10 years ago and basically forced Alonso into a early retirement.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I mean, we're like, what, almost 15 years removed from Spygate or whatever it was. But I can't help but wonder if there's still like a bit of a hangover from that era. And I also, like, when I think about it, I also ask myself, was Zak Brown the right person to do that job? You know, get kind of like this brash American guy in there. I mean, let's face it, you know, the Europeans are probably going to be way too political and way too polite about it. Not saying that Zak can't be political if he needs to, but, you know, and I wouldn't say suggest putting a Canadian person in because we're probably too polite and nice as well. So I think he might have been the right person to do that. I mean, he's obviously, you know, he's been around for a while and knows what needs to be done. So I think he was the right person to take that job at the right time, and they've benefited from it. So, I mean, whether or not they will ultimately get to where he wants the team to go while he's there, that's, you know, that's the big million-dollar question, but it's fun to watch. I've got a trivia question for you, because I never knew this. Are you familiar with the American game show Wheel of Fortune?
Yes, I know this.
So you have heard that story. Yeah, when Zak was on there as a teenager or something. I did not know this story until, you know, a couple of weeks ago. And I was texting with my brother-in-law who lives on the other side of the country. He's a big F1 fan as well. So we talk about the news regularly. Anyways, he sort of brought up this Wheel of Fortune story with Zak Brown on there. I'm like, what are you talking about? So there's a clip of this still on YouTube, and he sent it to me. I said that's extraordinary. I thought I do boast of all these little niche-y kind of like very, you know, very specialized you know, trivia bits in F1. I said I never knew that one, and I thought it was very, very cool.
Yeah, it's really cool. I think there's even a little bit more, because I think he wins like $3,050, but it's like of products, and then he goes and sells those products. Apparently this might be might be made up, but he goes and sells his product and then buys a kart, and that's sort of his first way into driving, into racing,
right?
Kind of thing. So that bit could be made up, but I choose to believe it, because that'd be a great story. He won the start of his motorsport career on Wheel of Fortune. That'd be very, very cool.
Yeah, I mean, I can't remember exactly what he has in his garage at home of, like, you know, these, you know,
oh my god,
like,
yeah,
amazing cars. I've seen pictures, and I'm just like, if I even had one, I would be the happiest guy. You know, it's just like, he's got this entire collection. I mean, he's done incredibly well. I mean, you can't hold him against him. It's just like, I'd be be happy. You know, Zach, if you were willing to divest yourself of one, you know, or two, you know, I don't want you to feel left out today, Sam. Yeah. He wouldn't notice.
Yeah, and, yeah,
we'd be feeling pretty happy. But, you know, I feel like now we should shift the discussion a little bit because we've touched on it a couple of times, rather tangentially, but we haven't really talked about Mercedes. So here we are a couple of years into the Red Bull dominance in Formula One. And I must admit that I find myself becoming exceedingly frustrated with the Mercedes. And I know we're in a cost cap era, and previously, before you could spend whatever you wanted to, that every time they had a problem, they were able to sort it out. And I was always under the impression that they have the right people, the right facilities and everything. And I know it's a little bit more complicated, you know, with wind tunnel time and CFD modeling and stuff like that. So I know it's just not as simply as just, you know, using the time and whatever allotted to yourself. Like it's a lot tougher to really sort out problems now on the fly compared to compared into the past. But having said that, they were still very, very competitive in 21. Then they come out with the new car in 22, the W13, this, you know, complete shift in design philosophy, which was a disaster. It didn't work, and I was shocked, as many people were, that they brought basically a new iteration back to the grid last year in the W14, only a quarter, a third of the way through the season, to finally, you know, admit or make the decision, yeah, this just isn't working, so we do have a plan B. So they went to a plan B, which, you know, I mean, it did work, because ultimately the end of the day, you know, the results spoke for themselves. But here we are, you know, three races into the 2024 championship, and they're floundering again. You know, it's just like I feel like it's just like, you know, this sort of stop and starts, and you know, it's frustrating to watch, because when you look at the way that, and I realize the irony what I'm going to say here, is I'd love to see them take the fight to Red Bull after, you know, I complained for a decade that, you know, I wish somebody else would win races other than Mercedes. So I know there's a bit of irony in that statement there, but it's frustrating to watch them kind of struggle the way that they are.
Yeah, definitely. I think for as much as we were talking about there's a good mood at McLaren Ferrari, I think the exact opposite is true at Mercedes. And like, I think the worst problem for them is they don't know how to fix it. Like we're sort of into the third year now of their crisis. And I think the first year you could explain off, okay, maybe they were completely caught out, maybe by porpoising or whatever. Like maybe it was just a fluke year. Second year, they come with that same package, which for some reason they believed worked, and it just didn't. And maybe they explained it saying, okay, we only switched the car halfway through the season, whatever it was. But this year, like, what's their excuse going to be? Like, they've got a car which they think was better, and I think both drivers have found it like really hard to drive, and I think they're definitely behind Red Bull and Ferrari. They're probably a little bit behind McLaren as well, and they've got Aston Martin chasing them as well, so they're probably the fourth best car on the grid. And I think there's got to be question marks now of the people in charge. Like, it's really much the same team that produced a lot of their winning cars 5-6 years ago, whatever it was. Like, so what's happened now that they're struggling so much? Why can't they seem to find the right answers, really? And I think Toto Wolff has sort of said in the first year they had issues with like their data correlating, and then they fixed it, and now it's gone back to not being right. Like, how does that happen? Like, where's the problem here that you're being so far behind Red Bull and behind Ferrari and all that? Like, there's an issue somewhere. Like, I don't know what it is, whether the people just aren't suited for these types of regulations, like the car doesn't fit their skill set kind of thing, or whatever it is. I think the main problem with this Mercedes car is it's just so hard to get in the right window. Like, I think compare it to the Red Bull, where like I think anyone who's an F1 driver could jump in it and drive fairly quickly, fairly well, and put a good lap in. I think Liam Lawson actually touched on this recently. He said that Max only needs like one practice lap, and then he can do pretty much a full speed quali lap if you wanted to. Whereas the Mercedes is completely different. Like, they could go for a whole hour of a session and come away thinking, well, we don't have any clearer idea of what we need to do to that car to make it work, really. And like, that's a huge worry. Like, regardless of if it's a quick car or not, like, not understanding the car is a bigger issue than having a slow car, I think, because at least with a slow car, you know what's going wrong and you can try and fix it. Whereas with Mercedes at the moment, it feels like they're just trying a lot of different things and nothing's coming off. And I think into the third season now, I think you do start to get some like existential questions about Mercedes. Like, we're used to them being this absolute title force, like they're just winning time after time. And I think in 2022, obviously, we still consider them the title favourites going into the year. 2023, I think a lot of people thought they're going to be back. They're still a title contender. And I think some people, maybe not title contenders, but up there or so, or about, like, when does that stop being the case? When do you stop being an automatic title contender? And I think you could look at like someone like McLaren, obviously Williams as well. Like, they've sort of gone downhill in the same way, kind of thing, where you become not a title favorite anymore. And I think Mercedes are in a real danger of doing that. Like, of all the teams where, like, you talk about momentum, I think they're the bottom of it, really, because they've got an unreliable car that's not working well. They've got their best driver, the huge name. He's leaving for a rival team. At the moment, they haven't filled that second seat with regardless who it's going to be. Like, yeah, it's just a lot of like big ifs and a big buts. And I think largely a worrying time for Mercedes. Like, it's hard to see how they pull themselves out of it, really.
Well, that's a great parallel that you draw between McLaren and Williams, who dropped off the map and really became irrelevant for a very long time. And I mean, it was very... You know, Williams especially, because they're an interesting case, because they were a team that was good for an odd podium here and there, even, you know, going back to 2016 or thereabout, because, I mean, it was after the end of that season, because, I mean, you had Massa and Bottas that were the driver pairing there. That was a pretty good pairing. I mean, they were good for top tens, good for the occasional podium here or there. And then it's after that era changed. You know, first of all, you had Bottas obviously going to Mercedes in 2017. I mean, the way that they fell into the abyss was so abrupt. I mean, it was literally like flicking a light switch, pardon me. And I know that they've shown some, you know, some flickers of hope in the last year or so. I think they've got a really good person in James Vowles, who's the team principal. Alex Albon, I think, is a vastly underrated driver that just didn't work out with him at Red Bull, and I really admire the courage, you know, the balls that he had, you know, to be a little bit crude, to break away from the Red Bull cabal and take that drive at Williams. So we've seen something, but I mean, it's not to the, you know, similar level yet of the renaissance that we've seen with McLaren. And like I was saying earlier, I love the combination that they have of Lando and Piastri. But, you know, more to the point of like Mercedes, I mean, they are at this very weird kind of like place I don't think anybody expected them to be, because I know for like, you know, the big names, so like your Adrian Newey's and like these key people, that there's only a few of them in Formula One regardless what team they're at. But you would think for, you know, all the worker bees, and I kind of hate to kind of like down talk or downplay the importance that anybody has within one of these teams, you would think that Mercedes would be like, okay, if they're hiring engineers, that they could basically take the hundreds of applications and just take the cream and go through them. So, I mean, it's not like they would have problems, at least on paper, you would think, to get the people that they need. But I'm just, as you were talking, I just pulled up the constructor standings for this year. So you've got Red Bull and Ferrari. There's only 4 points separating the two of them after three races, which I think is brilliant. 97 for Red Bull, 93 for Ferrari. Then you got McLaren, who is just a little bit further back with 55, which is, you know, when you look at their fortunes through three races, seems, you know, quite correct to see where they are. And then you've got Mercedes and Aston Martin with 26 and 25 points, respectively, who've struggled through the first couple of races. And it's very, very frustrating to watch. I mean, again, you look at, what happened in Australia. I mean, a double DNF. You know, you have Lewis retiring with a mechanical, and of course, you know, George had that incident with Fernando, which is a bit of an interesting one, but still, you know, a double DNF, and, you know, the best they've mustered so far was Lewis getting a P5 in Bahrain and a P6 in Saudi Arabia, and George a little bit further behind. So they've kind of reestablished that driver order, because I feel like 2 years ago, I feel like after after Abu Dhabi. And I don't think that we can really blame Lewis for this. I think he found himself in a bit of a strange headspace, because that first season he was partnered with George. George was the better, he had the better results, but last year it flipped around. And at least, you know, through the first couple of races this year, Lewis has had on paper some better results. But that is a team that continues to confound and frustrate. I don't know. Like, where do you think they go from here? Or is it, Toto's committed for a couple more years. I mean, all the key people are still there. I mean, apart from Lewis, but they could still make a splash and sign somebody like a Carlos Sainz, for example, a good, not a similar, but a good replacement for Lewis.
Yeah, I mean, that's a tough question to ask where they go, really. Like, I think this is sort of why I think these Max to Mercedes rumors, I think they've got very little substance, because why would Max do it? Like, why would he, not only would he leave Red Bull, which is quite clearly the best team, but he'd go to, like I mentioned, like the fourth best car, really? Mm. Like, why would you do that if you're a serial winner? So as to where they go, it's really tough. Like, I mean, James Allison as well, their technical chief, just signed a new contract. Like, he's committed. Like, at some point, someone's going to have to take blame for this poor car. And like, initially, we thought it was Mike Elliott, who obviously got moved on last year, like, and now doesn't work for them anymore. Mm-hmm. Maybe he was to blame, but we've seen James Allison come in, a guy who's made championship-winning cars in the past, and yet he hasn't done it again. So I don't know. I think there might be a bit more pressure on Toto Wolff if he wasn't also a third owner of the team. Like, he owns 30% of the team. It's probably quite hard to criticize the man who owns part of the team. Like, who's he going to blame? Like, the other 60%, are they going to start pointing fingers? But yeah, that he's probably got that as a bit of a shield. And I do think he's still the right person to lead them. And I think, like we mentioned with like Zak Brown and McLaren and stuff like that, they just need like a regeneration project. Like, they just need to sort of get some more good engineers in, because I think we've seen a lot of the talent leave the Mercedes base and go to places like Red Bull and McLaren and stuff like that. Like, they've gone off to different parts within the UK, really. And I think they just need like a freshening of the ideas. Like, it's clearly not working. And I think this car was billed as the rebrand, did you like the rebirth kind of thing, like the second coming of Mercedes, and it hasn't worked out. Like, we can all admit now it hasn't worked out. It might get better as the year goes on, but the more races it takes, the bigger that gap that you talked about is going to become. So yeah, it's really tough to see where they go. I appreciate I haven't really given you an answer there, but I think if I did have the answer, I'd get paid millions of pounds.
That's it, right? But
yeah, to be honest, I don't know what's going to happen. I think, yeah, it's looking like an increasingly bad season for them. And I think if you look at them and Aston, I think Aston are probably where they should be, really. Like, they had a really good year last year, but for a team of their caliber, sort of where they come from, pretty much a new team. Obviously, they've had a few different guys over the year, but this sort of top-end team are very much new, and they're sort of figuring out the ropes, whereas Mercedes should be well above them, should be well clear and getting their sort of the way they build cars working more efficiently, and they're just struggling with that. So yeah, I'm afraid I don't know what's going to happen next. I mean, it's just going to get worse, unfortunately.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, it's just it's been a struggle. I mean, it's like been one misfire after another. But you said one thing there that I just wanted to pick up on. Then, you know, you give very little credence to the Max to Mercedes rumors, and like many people, I've thought about this quite a bit recently, and I've come to a couple of different conclusions. Number one, it could be a bit of a power play on like Team Verstappen to put pressure internally at Red Bull to, you know, for whatever reason. Maybe it's to push Christian Horner out the door. Maybe it's for some other, you know, something else. So there's that theory. The other theory is too, and not that I necessarily, you know, kind of like threw Lewis into the, you know, the I have to win everything and be the best ever. I think that, you know, Lewis and the trajectory that his career has had and the wins and the championships and, you know, just his talent have kind of put him into the place where he is now, that one more championship, he's the best ever. And I think that I think that the reason why that a lot of people root for Lewis is because Lewis, I think, means a lot to a lot of people in a lot of different ways. You know, you've got this guy that comes from a very normal, humble, working class background, and he's gone on to do amazing things in and outside of Formula One. And he just seems like just generally a very likable guy. You know, having said that, I'm sure that there's always egos involved. And I'm sure to some point that, you know, some degree, Lewis is like, yeah, I'd love to be the best ever. But, you know, Max, and I find that, you know, he's interesting too. And you probably found this as a journalist. Like I did a lot of journalism, you know, covering, you know, like Major League Soccer in North America here for a long time. And it didn't matter if it was players, coaches, executives. There's a couple of different categories of people that you have. You have the people that hate doing the media work and they just show up. It's like, ask me my three questions or whatever it is. I'll give you a one sentence answer. I'm out of there. Then you have the people that like it and love doing it and are good at it. And then you've got the people that are somewhere in between that they love doing it, but they're not very good. You know, they're just not very good in front of a camera or a microphone. And I think that Max, you know, it's funny because when you see kind of promotional stuff and you kind of see Max kind of, you know, mingling with other people, he seems much more relatable. But when he gets behind a microphone or in front of a camera, he seems a bit dry and a little bit kind of, you know, it's like, ask me my three questions and I'll give you my answers kind of thing. But, you know, it's funny too, but I just kind of feel that if it came down to it, that's the reason why I could see him potentially going to Mercedes. And, you know, like I say, I would agree with you. I think that, you know, it seems doubtful, but I'm not convinced that Max wants to stay in it until he's 45 and completely obliterate the record book. Although he had a very good crack at it last year, obviously. I wouldn't be surprised at some point he's like one of those guys that'd be just like, you know what, I've done everything I've came here to do. And, you know, I'm happy and I walk away. Maybe he's 30, maybe he's 35, you know, whatever that is. But I could also see him doing, like, moving to Mercedes because, you know, I could honestly see it happening just from that scenario. It's just something different to do. It's like, well, like, and you have to think too, he's driving without pressure. He's won three championships now. Well, two, maybe with an asterisk, depending who you ask, but you know what I mean? I mean, he's a multiple world champion and I think he's driving without pressure. I think he can basically do what he wants. And I feel that if he was to go to a team, let's say even like Mercedes, who struggled, I mean, it's the potentials, it could only get better. If not, then it's just like, he's doing things the way that he wants to. And that's to me why I think that story has a little bit of momentum to it. I don't know. Your thoughts, or am I just, you know, is this with a lot of hot air? It is, but
yeah, I agree. Like, I think Max is a completely fascinating person. Like, I've like the way he goes about things, I think he's almost entirely different to any race driver we've ever seen. Like, he's completely not asked about anything. Like, he just wants to go and have a drive.
Exactly.
Like, he'll do it. It's fine. Like, and I think that's where the media stuff comes from. Like, I have a lot of sympathy for the drivers because obviously, like, we see like maybe one interview in English and sort of think, oh, maybe that's their media. But that Thursday must be horrible for them because they've got media in English, they've got it in their own language, they speak to so many different broadcasters and over the course of a day, and they're just getting asked the same questions over and over again. Like, he's going to be bored. So I think that sort of explains that media element of it. And maybe, yeah, when he's doing more fun things, like obviously Red Bull do quite a lot of fun, like, marketing stuff, and he seems to be a bit more relatable, like you said, like a bit more like a real human when we see him doing that. And I think that's probably more who he is rather than the guy who's got to sit in the press conference. And yes, it is good to win all those races, but that does mean that you've got to have a press conference pretty much after every single race where they ask you, how did you do? He's like, I just won the race. What do you want? But I think I would take your idea of him not being bothered, but I would say instead of going to Mercedes, I could see a situation where he just leaves F1. Like, it's something that he's threatened a lot. Like, he said that he doesn't care about winning seven titles in a row or whatever. Like, for him, winning one world championship was it, and this is pretty much like an extra. So he's a guy who loves racing. I mean, anyone who's ever seen him, like, on the day of an actual event, F1, he's back doing sim racing. He's in his hotel room, like, got his own little setup, and he's clearly absolutely loves racing. So I could see him easily leaving at the end of this Red Bull contract and going and say, okay, I want to do something else. I want to do like Le Mans, or I want to do like WEC or whatever. Like, I think that's, in my mind, that's more likely than him going to another team. Because I think if he does stay in F1, he's going to want to stay at a team that he's going to win races at, because that's how he finds racing enjoyable. He probably wouldn't enjoy being 10th or 9th. And I know he's done it a bit when he was at Toro Rosso, but I think this Max is only really focused on winning races. And I think he's a guy who wants to do a lot. I mean, you have to look at his dad. Like, his dad's still like racing now, isn't he? In like various events around the world. And I think that's the situation that Max could do quite easily. So yeah, I sort of agree with you that he might walk away from Red Bull earlier than a lot of people expected, but I think maybe off to a different series or to do whatever he wants, really, because let's be honest, he's a millionaire. He can just sit by the pool if he really wanted to. But I think we'll see him in a cockpit of a different car rather than a Mercedes.
Yeah, you know, isn't that really the dream, though, to be able to do what you want when you want on your own terms? I think that's what the rest of the 8 billion of us on the planet want to do. And there's only a few people that could do that. But that's an interesting take on that, Sam. You know, I could actually see that happening if he decided, you know what, I'm done. You know, I've had my fill of Formula One. And it would be completely different to say what Nico Rosberg did, you know, back in 2016. It was one and done. And you know, that was surprising too, because it was a very sudden kind of thing. And then Nico just decided, okay, I'm finished. I'm not up for the challenge again. You know, I don't want to try and defend this title to Lewis Hamilton. But it's different. And I think that, you know, Max would, you know, he would leave on a completely different mentality and kind of like you say. I mean, his dad is still racing and doing different things as well. So, I mean, I could see Max absolutely doing that. So I guess kind of like the long way around, we've kind of worked into the silly season. And I guess we might as well just talk with Red Bull. I mean, say the unthinkable happens and say that this Max to Mercedes scenario actually pans out, that, you know, potentially we could have like two seats open at Red Bull next year. I mean, everybody would be salivating to get that seat. I mean, and then, I mean, that's also to assume that Sergio Perez doesn't make a good claim on that that seat this year. I mean, all he really needs to do is finish behind his teammates, you know, however he accomplishes that. I mean, I know it must be extremely frustrating for them and for him at Red Bull, because, you know, he's like, as you mentioned earlier, he's not the greatest qualifier. So he leaves himself work during the race, and that doesn't always work out, even though he's got the ideal car to slice his way through the pack. I thought it was interesting last week in Australia. Remember when he passed George, and George is on the radio, he's saying something, he's like, holy smokes, this car is like a rocket. And it was interesting. You could see, just watching Checo on like the helicopter shot, pulling away from George. And I was just like, gosh, you know, how discouraging must that be for another driver to get past like that? That slowly, you know, very quickly, watch him disappear down the track in front of you. But your thoughts, like just on that potential alone, to have two vacant seats at the team everybody wants to drive for at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, that's when silly season really gets silly, doesn't it? If like,
yeah,
have we ever had a situation where the best car on the grid suddenly has two free slots? Like, it'd be like, I don't know, like Mercedes both losing both their drivers in the late 2010s, like, it'd be mad. Like, and I think there'd be a whole number of drivers queuing up, and it depends what Red Bull want to go for, really, because I think Sainz could be an obvious candidate because he's doing well, but I also think they'd really want like a marquee signing to sort of like replace Verstappen. I think there's very few drivers that sort of fit that bill, and I think, as we mentioned earlier, two of them have just signed long-term contracts in Leclerc and Lando, and whether Red Bull go all out and sort of break the bank, and that very much would be breaking the bank to get either of them out of their deals, having just signed them. But whether they do something like that just to replace Verstappen, because I think you've got to do something to sort of save face, really, like to say, okay, Verstappen's gone, this is a new era, kind of thing. But it's going to cost a lot of money to do that. That's one option. Maybe they go for a different option. I mean, Alonso's been making kissy faces pretty much ever since the news came up that he might be in of contention, and whether they go for that, I mean, that'd be fireworks, wouldn't it? Alonso in a Red Bull, like him crashing with Helmut Marko. I think we'd all love to see. That'd be incredible.
So sign me up.
Maybe they go for I'll have that now, please. Thank you.
Yes.
So maybe they go for that. But yeah, I think they'd be in a similar situation to Mercedes. Like, who on earth do we get in to replace our big star that's suddenly left us with that much warning? So yeah, I think hugely exciting. Like, if Max does stay, I think there's still a lot of debate about that next seat. I think Perez has done more than enough currently to hold on to that seat, because obviously he's got P2 in two of the races. Didn't do so great in Australia, obviously, but compared to someone like Ricciardo, who's obviously been linked to his seat a lot, he's absolutely blowing out the water, so that's fine. But whether Perez leaves from Red Bull's team, or maybe he wants to leave himself, like, that obviously opens up space. But yeah, there's a lot of, like, I don't know, if you put it like on a scale, there's a lot of like 7 out of 10 good choices, but there's not like that clear candidate. I think a lot of people probably thought that was going to be Ricciardo. Hasn't worked out. So, like, yeah, you have to sort of go to not a plan B, but just maybe a different sort of plan. So, yeah, A lot of drivers could fit the bill. I mean, it's up to Horner and whoever wants to make that big call of who they actually get in.
Yeah, it makes you wonder that if, that seat actually opened up and they wanted, like you say, that marquee signing. I wouldn't be surprised if they tried to, finagle some sort of deal to get Lando away from McLaren. I mean, the Horner was out there just to, over the winter, many times saying how much he'd love to see Lando Norris at a Red Bull. And Lando, I'm sure, would love to be at a Red Bull, as would 19 other guys as well, but that would be incredible. And I think that's just with all these different developments that we've seen over the past couple of months, that it's funny because we've always, you tend to get like this logjam in the top teams, is that drivers tend to go there and they sort of depart one at a time. And another person will sort of like slot in. So the fact that we're having so many discussions about these three teams at the top, and this sort of like Rubik's cube of different combinations of drivers, I think is absolutely fascinating, because it's not a conversation that we have very, very often. And it's kind of funny too. You just kind of have to wonder, is like what goes through like Charles's head or Lando's head, is like they sign these long-term deals and it's like, oh yeah, now he, like Max is leaving, it's just like I could just imagine them going into the factory and like Maranello or Woking the next day, hey, did you guys see this on the news this morning? Look at what the guys at Planet F1 is, this like big contracts here and there, and like Max is leaving. So it is fun though, because the scarcity, like the whole supply and demand thing, there's 20 of these cars and untold number of qualified drivers to get into them and do amazing things to them, and plus the drivers we never get to see that never percolate up to the top because they don't have the funding or whatever it might be to be appropriate choice for a Formula One seat. I think it makes it even more interesting, and it's funny too, because when you get to the top, they tend to recycle these drivers through like the top teams. So it's a little bit different than almost any other sport, unless, I don't know, maybe the only like one sort of like a parallel I can kind of like draw is maybe Tom Brady in the NFL, that played till like he was 45 and won all those championships in New England and then goes off to Tampa Bay and wins one. But I mean, it's not like he went through three or four or five different teams to do it. I mean, you look at like a Carlos Sainz and his resume. Toro Rosso, Renault, McLaren, Ferrari. I mean, at 29, years of age, he's going to be on to, we assume, his fifth team of his career, starting next year. So it's interesting how they kind of, cycle around. But, Formula One is, completely unlike any other sport on the planet. And it's not like a football player. You can be playing in the English Premier League one day, you can be playing in Italy the next week, or Japan, or wherever. I mean, it's so much different,
Yeah, it's definitely a crazy sport. Like I said, it's just so competitive, and I think teams are really really hesitant to try out the youth, really, aren't they? Like, I think we saw it with Haas. Obviously, they had two rookies. Granted, it was Mick Schumacher and Mazepin, and that pretty much set them like, we're never doing that again. Let's stop doing that. Let's get two of the oldest guys on the grid, two of the most experienced. Because I think F1 teams really like trust experience, and it takes a very bold decision to move away from that. And I think we could almost say that same with Alpine, couldn't we? Because they had the young prospect, and they were very hesitant about giving me any assurances, putting him in the car, and eventually they lose him to McLaren. So I think the bigger teams maybe have a bit more freedom to be a bit bolder, but yeah, I'm not surprised that those sort of same names like go around different teams, just because teams want to have, like, you've got so many variables with your car that you want the driver to be like a done deal, like you want to know what you're getting. So someone like Hulkenberg, you know what you're gonna get, whereas someone like with Behrman, like, it's very much a risk. So yeah, I'm not surprised that all these drivers sort of, once they're in kind of thing, and they sort of hang around for a decade or so, or do like an Alonso and just hang around for half his life. So yeah, I'm not surprised that they sort of swap teams quite often.
Yeah, you know, unless you go back to like a previous era in Formula One, you go to like Nigel Mansell, who, you know, went through and eventually wins a championship, goes over to America, drives for Newman Haas, and then comes back to Formula One to McLaren, only to find out he doesn't fit into the car. And that kind of like, that's kind of it for his career. And not saying anything against Nigel. I've got, you know, a scale model of his right over the side, you know, here beside me. He was like, he was my hero growing up as a kid. I love watching Nigel Mansell, but it's funny the way that the sport is. So it's always something.
We need more arguments, because that's what caused him to leave to America. I think we need more team principals to have arguments with their drivers.
Yes, it's almost like, well, I guess it's the same almost like in any sport now, right? It's just like that the, compared to, not that it's necessarily a bad thing, but, you know, like athletes and drivers now, it doesn't matter what sport, it seems that they have more power, you know, like that they did in previous eras. You know, it's just like the manager just couldn't come in and, you know, put them in their place all of a sudden. It's just like nowadays well, you know, you don't like it, too bad, then, you know, I'm out the door, I'll go down to the next person that wants my services and they're willing to pay me what I want or whatever it might be. So
yeah, exactly.
Different
player power is mad
Well, Sam, thank you so much for coming and spending some time with me this afternoon. I really enjoyed the conversation. So before we let everyone go, you told us all about the new pod. Everybody knows obviously about all the fantastic work that you and the team over at Planet F1 have going on. What else are you working on? And you'll feel free to, you know, disperse that information, let everybody know where they can follow your social media, all the good stuff, where they can follow and keep up with what you're up to.
Yeah, so like I said, just please subscribe to the new pod, Pondering Papaya, easily found. If it's got any kind of orange on it, that's probably it. I'm Sam Cooper _ on most social media. Like, yeah, follow me for occasional tweets about stuff I'm doing. Like, I do some cool stuff, and like, hopefully you'll enjoy it. Like, I went to F1 exhibition recently. I'm going to talk about that soon. So yeah, that's where you find me. But yeah, I think the main one would be, please go and listen to the pod. Like as mentioned, we've got sort of a special episode in the works about Zac Brown. So I'm sure that'd be, hopefully be a good listen by the time it comes out. But yeah. And again, thanks to you for having me. Like, I absolutely love having a long chat about F1.
It was my pleasure, and look forward to doing it again sometime.
Me too. Sounds good.
All right. Well, that's it for tonight, everybody. Thank you very much for joining Sam and myself. If you would like to support us on the pod, please head on over to Apple or Spotify, wherever it may be. A 5-star rating review is the easiest and quickest way to support the work that we do here. Give us a follow on X at Scuderia F1 Pod. And if you want to send an email, you can also do that by sending an email to scuderiaf1pod@gmail.com. That's it. I hope you enjoy the rest of this lovely long weekend. And we'll be back in a couple of days. So bye for now.